Dr. George Wiggins, he's been sitting in the front row for 2 days. He's been itching to get up here. So, and if for those of you that don't know George, it doesn't take very long in a conversation with George to realize that, yes, maybe he's put a lifetime into it, but when you talk about speed and movement and what we can do next and what we can do better, his face just lights up with how we can improve on the knowledge that we've got. And I think it, you know, your title of where it can take us, and that's what drives you, George, and I think that's what really what's helped get us to where we are at all the research at AIPL and ARS and USDA has been forward with you and your team, and it's a pleasure to introduce Dr. George Wiggins this morning. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. And I really appreciate the chance to address an audience, the people that really use our results, the people who put money where basically where our mouth is with regard to this information. Just on the title slide here, I guess we see the cow. We like to look into her and see what the DNA actually is. And that's really been the thrill of genomics, is that it's enabled us to do that. Just a kind of adjustment. We were the Animal Improvement Programs Laboratory for a really long time, since I think 1972. But this past year, we joined with the Bovine Functional Genomics Laboratory to create this combined laboratory. From the ARS perspective, it got the people that do the computer work with the numbers together with the people that do the lab work to come up with the with the chips and the markers. So just so we're all talking about the same thing, genomics from the dictionary applies DNA technology and bioinformatics, and we know yesterday from what bioinformatics is, to sequence, assemble, analyze the function and structure of genomes. And it really does kind of describe what it is that we do. And then the SNPs that we all talk about is just the advance here was that we have a very simple thing to check. At each location in the genome, we find places where there's just one difference, so we can process these very efficiently, and that's what's led to the breakthrough, is the efficient determination of these genetic differences. And this all leads to genomic selection, so we can, using predictions of economic merit, basically early in life, the critical advantage. So we're kind of smug in the dairy cattle industry in that we figure we're kind of smarter than everybody else. We really put this genomics to work and have been capitalizing on its benefits. But we actually had some help getting started. We had extensive historical data. We had well-developed genetic evaluation programs, because genomics can't make something out of nothing. We had widespread use of AISRs, giving us a population structure that was amenable to this technology. Progeny test programs to capture data, high-value animals worth the cost of genotyping, a long generation interval that can be reduced substantially by genomics, thus the possibility of getting the benefits, particularly that Brian referred to yesterday. So we've had a long history. You know, it seems like only yesterday, but now it's it'll be 10 years in 2017 that the beet chips first became available. And I'll show you a picture, but Randy Blodgett actually has a chip if you want to see what it is that we're actually talking about when we talk about SNP chips. But when after those evaluations became available, or the chips became available, my colleague Paul Van Raden had been working on programs to evaluate the data using simulated data, so that we were very quickly able to make our first release of genomics-based evaluations in April of 2008. We made those evaluations official in January of 2009. We extended to Brown Swiss in August. We went to monthly evaluations in 2010, but basically because we got some assistance with the postdoc to help with the resources required, and that it's very disheartening to have to tell somebody that they just missed the deadline and it's going to be 2 months before they can get new information. The 3K chip, which we don't really hear much about now, but was quite important in extending the genomic revolution to females by reducing the cost. And that initial chip was improved on. Basically, the technology used on the 50K chip was extended to the LD, or 69,000 SNP chip, became available in 2011. And that's given it basically met our requirements for accuracy, which the 3K was a little bit deficient in. We added evaluations for AirSure in 2013, and we went to weekly evaluations just this past November. So a history of activity in this area, as you all know. I'm going to go through just what the process is so that when you think about genomic evaluations, you have a little bit of an idea of how it all works. So we have this structure of nominators, the organizations that submit genotypes to our process. Not everybody is open to do that. They have to be approved and meet certain capabilities, such as submitting, being able to manage pedigree information. We get the DNA sources are primarily hair and tissue. Tissue has become more important lately, particularly as Zoetis has had a protocol of using ear punches to as a data source. These are the chips that I was talking about. They're about the size of a microscope slide, and they have wells, one well for each animal that can be done. On the typically 24 animals, or there's 24 wells on a chip for most of the chips that we use. Then the genotypes are sent from the genotyping library to the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding for accuracy review. And that accuracy review is really an important part of the quality control, an area that I've spent considerable effort on. And it's actually one of the nice aspects of this data is that there's sort of internal checks that you receive data, you can check to see whether it really meets the standard of accuracy. And because these DNA genotypes are so reliable, it seems like we owe the data the effort to make it achieve its potential by requesting that it be reconfigured or reclustered if it falls short. But it's like three legs of a stool. We check call rate, the proportion of heterozygous, and the parent-progeny conflicts. Really, the parent-progeny conflicts are the proof of the pudding in the sense that we use these chips to track inheritance. So if the inheritance isn't correct, then there must be a problem. So for various reasons, some of these SNPs may not meet our needs. And the reason that there's, I call it a three-legged stool, is that each one sort of protects the others. If the call rate is very low, the SNPs that are left might be okay, but the genotype in general would be unreliable. If most of the calls are heterozygous, that pretty much precludes us being able to check the parentage accuracy. So by looking at all three, we can be confident that the genotypes we accept will be reliable. Clustering it can be investigated if the genotype for a particular animal fails or for a particular submission. And the number of SNPs failing indicates the genotype quality. We try to have fewer than 10 SNPs on a submission that fail in each of our categories. In case this is what the operator at the laboratory looks at when they're evaluating a batch of genotypes. Let's say a batch contains, say, 500, the genotypes in 500 animals, and it breaks down into, there's two possible alleles at this location. So the animal could have all of what we'll call A on in this group. This middle group would be 1A and 1B, and this group would be 2Bs. So what the computer tried to tell you and skip ahead was to say that by manually shifting the area that defines each of these clusters, we can move that call rate up to 100%. And although this is somewhat time-consuming work, the laboratories have been willing to do this based on the reports that we give them to identify SNPs that could be improved or for which there's some problem. So we have a process where they submit preliminary files of the results. We compare them, we do our analysis, send them back indicating where the issues are. They make adjustments like I've just described here and send it back for loading. So genotypes are modified as necessary. They're loaded into the database. The nominators receive reports, and this discussion about 15% parentage errors is about right. We have a substantial number that go back, but usually we're able to suggest what the correct sire is so that corrections can be made. I mentioned animal assignments because another possibility is that the samples got mislabeled, and that can also be detected because particularly in a case where the parents have generally been genotyped, or at least the sires, and a variety of sires have been used, we can see where this one genotype has the sire of this other animal and vice versa, so a simple switch can be detected. We deal with a variety of chips. I mentioned the 50K and the LD, and I'll show you a variety of chips that we have. But in order to use them in the analysis, we actually have to have a SNP genotype for each of the markers that we use. So imputation is a process that we use to estimate or figure out or derive what the genotype was for SNPs that were not observed. The SNP effects are estimated, so this is taking the traditional evaluations and associating them with the SNP effects to figure out what difference does it make in the value of each trait if you go from allele A to allele B. In other words, allele substitution effect. The final evaluations are calculated. So on this parent progeny, again, a lot of time is spent on this, and certainly the nominators will say it might be an inordinate amount of time they spend trying to correct these issues. But we also have kind of a two-level of pedigrees. The registered animals, or animals involved in some breed program, have their pedigrees supplied by the breed associations. If corrections are made, they have to be made through the breed association. And that's one benefit of that approach is we try to minimize the number of different differences in the information throughout the system. For great animals, the nominators typically report the pedigree, or it comes through milk recording, so they can correct those directly. The SNPs have been, as sort of everyone realizes, this has been a tremendous technology, and it's in the process of replacing microsatellites for parentage verification. It's not just a trivial process to say tomorrow we're going to start using SNPs, because you need to have that history of the genotypes of the parents. So I would say that I think the current status is that SNP information is accepted, but that microsatellite information is still used to investigate cases that are brought specifically to attention. So I guess I would say that both systems are in use. So picking up on our flow of results, the evaluations are released to the industry. Our group sends them to the nominators, and then it's responsible of the nominator to further send them to the owners. Weekly evaluations, as Rao mentioned yesterday, is limited to just new animals, which is the primary reason that we can do the calculations very quickly. On the monthly releases, we release all females and bulls not being marketed. And there the issue is that for marketing purposes, it's not useful to have the values changing marginally during the marketing period. So three times a year, every 4 months, the evaluations of all animals are updated. But that's when bulls being marketed also get new evaluations. I mentioned the various chips. I think we're up to 16 chips that are being used. You see they have a variety of markers or SNPs involved. Part of the reason is that a pool of reagents are created at the time a new chip is released. Over time, that pool can be consumed, and then there's an opportunity to just make a new batch or to create a new list of SNPs that we would like to have included. So many of the twos you see on the last part is a upgrade of the previous version of that same chip. We even have chips that are in use in Europe because there's exchange of genotypes. But the main thing to notice here is that we have a number of chips with number of SNPs below about 20,000, and then we have some above 50,000, and those are the two differences that I refer to here. So you see the overwhelming number of these chips that we get are from the lower, less expensive chips, but we get a reasonable number from the medium density. Many of these are bulls that are being returned to service, whereas there's the value in getting the additional accuracy that directly observing all of the SNPs provides. And the very high density is primarily for research projects. As far as the sex of these animals that are genotyped, you can see that with the advent of the lower cost genotyping, the females are really the overwhelming component here, with about 85% across breeds. And that Holstein is as you would expect, the vast majority of the animals genotyped, with Jersey being the second most numerous. Okay, it was mentioned that, of course, the focus is to try to further improve these genomic evaluations. So how can they be made more accurate? Well, there's a sort of a natural benefit of having additional bulls get their traditional evaluation. So this shows that in a 12-month period, how many new bulls got their traditional evaluations. So then they switched from having an evaluation totally based on genomics to have one based on traditional data, and therefore could contribute to improving the accuracy of the estimates, the SNP effect, so they become part of our predictor population. As a measure of what does genomics actually do for us, we periodically do what we call cutoff studies, where we sort of roll back time to say, given the data we had 4 years ago, what would our predictions be? And then we compare those predictions against the actual data for the bulls just recently receiving progeny tests. So the take-home message from here is that there is some variation across trait as to the utility or benefit that we get from genomics. You can see it ranges up as high as 54 points in reliability gain for fat percent. Similar story for type traits, although somewhat more similar across trait in this case. Okay, so in general, the reliability gains, Holsteins have the numerical advantage here because of the large number of animals gives us more accurate SNP effect estimates. But even with AirSure, we're getting some gain, and we're doing a research project with Guernsey's, which we expect somewhat similar results for. The bottom line is probably the critical thing that, again, was mentioned yesterday, that from the beginning, genomics has been a numbers game, so we immediately developed collaboration with Canada, partly from the research, and started with the research where the University of Alberta contributed some of the original 50K genotypes that we used. Then with Brown Swiss, again, the breed, in the hopes of having some possibility of getting accurate evaluations, we were able to arrange exchanges early on. And then more recently, all the countries that contribute to Interbull's genomic evaluation have released their data so that we can include it directly in our run. CDDR, which is the group that that is composed of several studs that collect semen straws, so we have a repository of semen that we can use for research, I concluded an agreement with Viking in Denmark so that we have a sharing of Jersey bull genotypes. And then the North American partners, basically the partnership of the US and Canada, was extended to include Great Britain and the Holstein Association in Italy. So that's, again, an opportunity to increase our number of genotyped animals, putting us more or less on a par with Eurogenomics. Another thing that we were able to do with genomics, and this was sort of driven by interest in whether the brachyspina condition could be detected or how accurately it could be detected from the SNP information. And as part of that study, we said, well, if we could do reasonably well with brachyspina, what about all of the other genotypes that we have? So it's not that we said these genotype tests aren't necessary. It's that we can use genotypes to extend a pretty good estimate of that information to animals that have not been tested for it. So all of these commonly known recessive characteristics, mostly in Holstein, but we have Mulefoot as well, are now part of our routine results. So in addition to giving genomic evaluations for the 31 traits we evaluate, we can also give these indications of whether this animal is expected to be a carrier for any of these characteristics. And that sort of led to the haplotypes affecting fertility. And the concept here is that if a particular region in the chromosome, we look at all of the markers that occur in that region, and we call that a haplotype, and we could have thousands of haplotypes for a particular region. But if we find that we never, or if it occurs that we never find the same haplotype, the same set of markers from both chromosomes, that suggests that perhaps if that combination were to exist, it would be lethal, that the calf or the embryo that was formed, being homozygous for those haplotypes, would not be born and live long enough to be genomically tested. So early embryonic death was the most likely situation that we were looking for. So so this has been effective in finding some of these haplotypes affecting fertility. In that case, the proof is that if we then look to see whether the fertility evaluations of the bulls that we say are carriers are lower than you would be expected. So that's so not only do we find a lack of homozygous cases, but also a reduction in genomic evaluation for fertility. We run a program to see if new cases show up, and they could show up because as we get more data, the chances of, and there may be many cases where there's never a homozygous case, but there may be so few occurrences of that haplotype that it wouldn't be decisive. But as we get more data, then we can continue to check for these haplotypes affecting fertility. So a second haplotype in Jerseys was the most recent one we found, located on chromosome 26. And the carrier frequency has dropped considerably, and you might say, how could that happen? But if this affects fertility, there could be selection for improved fertility, so that fortunately the occurrence is much lower now than it was in earlier decades. But the effect on conception rate was fairly substantial, so that somewhat supports that it being almost automatically selected against. We have not actually found the causative variant, the exact place on the chromosome that causes this, and we'll be sequencing, i.e. getting all of the variants on animals to try to narrow this down. This kind of gets to the meat of why this whole process is so effective. So you can see that the age of the parents, so these are how old were the sires of the bulls that were being marketed by birth year? So a fairly dramatic drop as the impact of genomics, and not as dramatic a drop for females, but some there as well. So this is really getting at why does genomics have the impact it does? It's because the drop in the age of parents and therefore the shortening of the generation interval. Now, there's always a concern. We've spoken about inbreeding, and if we do selection, that means that we favor some families over others. And so that you somewhat expect some increase in inbreeding. And as I said, with the drop in age of parents, we're turning over the generations more rapidly, and inbreeding actually increases by generation. So you see a little bit of an uptick in that line of the inbreeding by birth year. Fortunately, the expected future inbreeding reflects when we take the animals and breed them with a prospective population in the future, what inbreeding do we expect? And thereby, the large number of bulls that we use, because we do use more bulls with using young bulls, they don't produce as much semen, that we see that we've somewhat reduced the rate of increase there. The message here is that it may not be as bad as you feared because of the increase in inbreeding, because we have tools to deal with it. Another indication of the degree that genomics has revolutionized the industry, these are the marketed bulls. You see the decline in those that are traditionally progeny tested and the increase in those that are marketed due to genomics. Another somewhat similar effect here is that of the bulls that are active AI, now these would be the ones with progeny test, because we distinguish active AI from genomic. So now we're, as of those born in 2010, over 70% had been genomic, and of course we expect that to go up to 100 eventually, because why would you have a bull that you did not use a genomic bull, but then progeny tested him and then marketed him as a proven bull? And then what does this all add up to? So in the early part of the last decade, we had this gain of about $20 per year in net merit. Then it jumped up. I don't really know the difference between those two. But the real issue here is that we got the approximately doubling that Ryan had referred to, and it probably would be doubling if we merged those first two groups together. So again, the process seems to be working. Now, there's a question of whether we're really delivering what we're advertising. So to address this, the question was, let's see how the rankings of Bulls changed over time. So I took the December 2012 net merits and compared them to the December 2014 for Bulls that got their first traditional evaluation in August. I wanted to use the second evaluation just to deal with partial data issues that might occur on the first. And they had to have over 50 daughters in December so that we would feel that they had a fairly representative evaluation. So of the top 100 Bulls, of course, the argument is that I could talk about all the Bulls, but you're really only interested in the top ones. The average rank change was 9.6 positions. One Bull dropped 119, and another Bull rose 56. So we didn't get them all wrong. I think we did pretty well. So the correlation was 90.94, the regression is 0.92, and by the regression, what that means is that if we said that there was a pound difference between two bulls based on 2012, when we looked at the 2014 results, we found there was 92% of, 0.92 pounds. So didn't get 100%, but did pretty well. Okay, getting back to the topic of improving accuracy, we have a pretty successful system, but we're always trying to see how we can make it more accurate. So increase in size of predictor population is an obvious thing because we can get more accurate SNP effect estimates. We've already pointed out how we share genotypes across country. There's additional investigations going on to see if agreements can be reached with other groups. And I mentioned, I always showed the slide of the young bulls that received their progeny tests. Now, the benefit of increasing size, of course, would be greater for the smaller breeds than it would be for Holstein, given that we are reaching somewhat the point of diminishing returns. With Holstein, it's not only the about 28,000 bulls that have traditional evaluations. We also include over 50,000 cows. So we do have quite a substantial population. Now, if you don't use the cows, with the number of bulls we have, you don't lose very much. But we try to include all of the data that is helpful. Another approach is to use more or better SNPs. In other words, the SNPs aren't actually what causes the differences in the performance of animals. It's the fact that the SNPs are close to the places in the genome or on the chromosome that actually cause the differences. We could account for accounting for the selection for the effect of genomic selection on traditional evaluations, and I'll defer to Tom to give you some more detailed of the issues involved in that. We could perhaps reach more selection candidates. This may not be such a big opportunity for improving the accuracy of evaluations directly, but certainly as we as more animals are genotyped, and we spoke yesterday about what has to happen to make whole herd genotyping more profitable, that we reduce the number of misidentified sires, increase the accuracy of the traditional evaluations, that feeds into the accuracy of the genomics. The reason I'm not saying that, in principle, having more selection candidates should make things better because you have more animals to choose from, but to get a bull into AI, I suspect that most of the matings are already being made that to have much potential for meeting the requirements. Okay, so I mentioned more and better SNPs, and I also mentioned that we continue to get new chips. So there's a new chip that GeneSeq will be providing this month that has 143,000 SNPs expected. And one benefit of this chip is that it will include all the SNPs that we're currently using in our evaluations. When we created its predecessor, we thought that maybe we could exchange some SNPs, drop the ones that are probably less informative and add ones that were more informative. But when we did that, we found out the ones that we thought were less informative were still informative. So this restores those. Another, and somewhat related to that, Initially, we thought that to discriminate between animals, we want a marker that has about 50% minor allele frequency. In other words, half the animals will have one allele and half of them will have the other, because you have your best chance of distinguishing between animals. The downside of that thought, or the sort of error in our ways there, is that, of course, the job of the SNPs is to track the causative variants, the places in the chromosome that really make the difference. And those causative variants aren't likely to have a 50% gene frequency, so that if we want our SNPs to track them, we should have SNPs that are close to them and have a somewhat similar frequency. So following up on this research, we've begun to investigate the 143,000 SNPs. We've picked 85,000 that do show an increase in the accuracy of evaluation. And when this chip becomes available, we expect to transition to that and thus get a small increase in accuracy. Another chip that GeneSeq is offering this month is to address the concern about how do we reduce the cost of genomic evaluation so we can make it practical, again, for the whole herd approach. So this new chip that they've developed has 4,100 SNPs. It has built-in validation. This is a benefit for them that they can check to see whether they did the processes correctly by having markers that are on there just to show that the run was successful. It includes some single gene tests, a lot of the tests that I spoke about on the ones that we're imputing. So it basically does everything, gives you your parentage verification. It's a basis for imputing to get genomic evaluations, and also has some single gene tests. Although dropping the number of SNPs in comparison to the lowest SNP that we're routinely using now, which has 6,900 SNPs, you do get somewhat lower accuracy, imputation accuracy. In other words, your ability to figure out how to fill in the missing SNPs if neither parent is genotyped, because the imputation draws heavily on having the parents genotyped. But it's the accuracy is within 1% of the accuracy of the LD chip if at least one parent is genotyped. And again, with the widespread use of AI bulls, the AI bulls, unless they're a foreign bull, perhaps, would have been genotyped. So this chip should be quite valuable and provide comparable results. Another use, along the issue of why should I invest in genotyping, we've done some work on mating programs. This was done by a postdoc that we had funded by NAB, who looked to see if we could increase the value of the resulting animals if we had a mating program that used genomic information to find the best combination of sire and dam, and certainly minimizing inbreeding. It's not just inbreeding that we say by how related are the parents, it's inbreeding by we can figure out by actually looking at the genotypes and finding out how to what degree do the both parents have the same alleles versus differences. So the mating program certainly can avoid mating carriers, can consider non-additive gene action, and that the benefit of that is not great, but invest the money, you have the genotype, it's another value that can be derived from it. Some may attempt to look for outliers by increasing the variance. In other words, mating two animals that are more different than average just because they hope that they can get something special. Okay, we talked about the changes. We always want to show that we're doing something. So we had the update in the net merit that you've all adjusted to. Grazing merit was added to basically give more importance to reproduction given the need to have cows calving on a 12-month cycle. A genomic mating program was implemented wherein we provide to studs and breed associations the inbreeding, the genomic relationship between a set of bulls that are likely to be in use or have been in use recently and all the females that we have genotypes on. And the reason that genomic relationship is important is that's really what causes the inbreeding. If the parents are related, then they have more chance of their progeny having homozygous recessive characteristics being expressed. We did the base change, the weekly evaluations, the new computer programs was emphasized, and the point that wasn't mentioned was that this gives us more flexibility. If we want to change the model, it's a simple specification of program rather than going in and trying to remember what we did 20 years ago and how to make the changes. The definition of daughter pregnancy rate was changed to provide a slightly better value, when I believe it has slightly higher heritability. And the weekly evaluations, they're released at 8 a.m. on each Tuesday to the nominators and the breed associations and the dairy record processing centers. Part of the idea here is to provide as many avenues to get the data to the owners as to make it convenient for them to incorporate this information. To make the calculations rapid, it's restricted to genotypes that first became usable. So that's genotypes submitted, as well as those where parentage errors have been corrected, so they're now allowed to into the system. And the computing time is minimized, not only doing the new animals, not calculating reliability or inbreeding, but we have developed fast approximations for those. So keep tuned, these may get added. This is really a very interesting area to work in, and to some extent, we're victims of our own success in that systems that we developed when we had maybe 10,000 genotypes really had to be modified in order to deal with the nearly 900,000 that we have now. So we make these periodic adjustments to maintain acceptable processing time. One issue is when we load the genotypes, as I pointed out, we detect whether the parents are in conflict. We also we discover the sire. So now, instead of using all of the SNPs that we receive, we've picked out 1,000 sort of representative SNPs and make those decisions based on that subset. But sort of a benefit of the weekly evaluations is a sort of a test drive of strategies that we may have to adopt on the monthly evaluations to keep the time required within bounds. So for the future, it's an interesting research area, all the stuff to do. So if we use the term causative genetic variant, where is it if we could actually find in the DNA what causes these differences? Now, early on in the genomic era, if you will, looking for DNA markers, there was this thought that, maybe we'd find some that have big effect. And there's DGAD is the one that affects fat percent primarily, and that's a big effect. That's fairly straightforward to find, but there aren't a lot of other ones like that. So we talked about the infinitesimal model, which meant that the differences we see in animals are the result of the action of many, many genes, and that was a very desirable assumption to make for our statistical models, because we could come up with estimates of breeding values using that model that worked out pretty well. But we said this was the model, this was the assumption, and we used this to get the results, but maybe it's not really true. But it turns out it was a pretty good approximation. So what we're looking for here are genes that have a fairly small effect, but the heritability is not zero. We know something in there is causing these differences, so we're looking for them. The reason we're looking for them, and again, you might say, well, the system's working pretty well already. But we all know that there's crossing over, where during the replication process, chromosomes sort of interchange material. So a linkage that you had before, you say this marker is close to this causative variant, could be broken. It's no longer associated with that one. So we call that linkage decay. If we have the causative variant, then we don't have that problem. If we find the causative variant, that can be added to the chips. As I point out, we're getting updates probably every year. Unfortunately, we can't use that immediately, because in order to do the imputation, we have to have a sufficient stock of examples so we can say, this region, if we see these particular SNPs in this region, that means that these other ones in between probably got carried along with. The ability to find causative variants is accelerated by the availability of sequence data, and we're in the middle of projects to sequence a substantial number of animals so that we'll have a library of the genomes of a number of animals, and that will really inform our imputation. So even if we haven't sequenced an animal, we can look in amongst those that we have and try to figure out which unobserved variants it has. So the We have our set of SNPs, so we can find new ones, but until we can actually incorporate them in the evaluations, they really don't have any immediate benefit. They could be used as single gene tests, but to improve accuracy evaluation, we have to add them to the SNP set. So the chips can have more and more SNPs as the cost declines. So this is a direction that we've been going in. Probably the most, one that we talk about the most is that once we've invested in the genotypes, there's almost no cost or no additional genotyping cost to use it on more traits. As we have more specialized and high-tech dairies, that they have the ability to use information on more traits, and that in order to find that profitable cow, as we can consider more and more things, we can be more and more accurate in doing so. So there's a natural pressure towards applying genomics to more traits. The sort of obvious ones are disease traits. We've talked about feed efficiency, and these are all areas of research interest, and we expect to see progress. Within a few years, we expect to have added at least several more traits. We do quite well with Holstein. We have less accurate evaluations for other traits. Right now, when someone sends in a crossbred animal for genomic evaluations, we reject it. We'll do the parentage verification, but we say that with a crossbred, we don't know which SNP effects to use. To use the sire's breed SNP effects or to use the dam's breed SNP effects. We're not even sure how to do the imputation because the frequencies of the different haplotypes vary by breed. That doesn't prevent people from sending them in, and we see this as a service that they would like to provide, so we're working on strategies to be able to do that. Tom's going to talk about this genomic preselection, and that's the issue, again, victim of your own success. Traditional evaluations are based on having all the animals represented that you use to make selection decisions. So even though for later, say, the later lactations on a cow only occur on the better daughters of a bull, the fact that we had all the first lactations means that our statistical methods are able to deal with that. With genomics, the only progeny that a bull has, and the only bulls that have progeny, are those that pass the first stage selection. So if the system doesn't know about that, it can't really do the proper rankings. I mentioned that we're working on Guernseys. There's a collaboration with the UK, again, to get numbers and support for doing the genotyping. Collaborations are a good approach. So animals' genotype is good for all traits. Traditional evaluations are required for accurate estimates of SNP effects, so that's really the first step. They're not currently available for some traits. Feed efficiency is really a particularly good example of this issue. It's quite expensive data to collect. The research projects working with institutional herds are collecting it. But the question then is that if we have this based just on the research populations, will it really reflect what will occur in target populations? We may be looking at a fairly substantial effort to set up ways to collect this data. As far as what are we working on now, the idea to find these causative variants, it'd be desirable to use all of the massive amount of information we have already to find the promising places in the chromosome to look for. So working with Dr. Joel Weller in Israel, we're using a granddaughter design to help us find those regions, which we'll then investigate more completely with sequence data. We have an international collaboration with the same countries we collaborate on the genotypes, and we're also participating in a project that's centered in Melbourne, Australia, to have genomes sequence data on 1,000 bulls. And there we've participating and hope to get some bulls of interest in a month or so. So in conclusion, genomic valuations dramatically changed dairy cattle breeding. I don't think there's any disagreement on that point. The rate of gain has increased primarily because of the large reduction in generation interval. The rate of genetic change is really related to generation interval and accuracy of evaluations. So the fact that we have not had to sacrifice much in accuracy to have an evaluation on a bull as a month-old calf compared to the information we'd have when he was 5 years old, that's why we've been able to drop the generation interval and get almost a corresponding increase in rate of gain. So genomic research is ongoing to detect causes of variance, to find more haplotypes that affect fertility. As I said, that's every month we search through the data to see if there's additional ones and ways to improve accuracy. So that's what I had to say.
Well, thanks, George. I think certainly it's so intensive on how much is how much you can put into 40 slides, and I think you know, it takes a lot of time to absorb the past and the present and what's going to come forward in the future as well. So certainly, I have a couple questions for George, but I open the floor to everybody as well. It's certainly got a lot of scientific background and data to bring forward. So I do encourage questions for George, how we can move forward. Greg?
So the question is, what is the limit on the accuracy? And as I was pointing out, that we're not seeing as much gain in Holsteins as we add more bulls to the predictor population. We do expect that with more SNPs, we can get more accuracy. So to get into some of the nuts and bolts of how the system works, we sort of distinguish between how much of the genetic variation or the heritability that the SNPs will explain versus what's left over that we can't explain. Right now, we've set that the SNPs can explain 90%, and there's 10% left over that we say this is an effect due to all the genes, and the ones that the SNPs can't pick up. So that's that is an upper limit. We're not going to get above 90% reliability, even as we make various improvements, so long as the SNPs can't really explain all of that variation. Whereas when you look at the daughters, if you have 10,000 daughters, you've pretty much nailed what that bull's worth. As far as the 80%, I think you'll find genomic bulls that have a reliability of 80%, so in some sense, we're already there. It'll be a slow slog to increase very much. We should see slight increases as we go along. I guess the goal may be more of making sure that we deal with issues, as we mentioned, in genomic preselection or other things that are happening. And the causes of variance probably aren't the kind of thing that's going to raise the whole population much. It's certainly worth doing, avoiding the linkage decay is an obvious thing. It has the potential for being useful across breed, and it's certainly of great scientific interest because once we find it, then it's interesting to know what's the biochemical pathway that causes this to be effective. Is it located in a gene that makes sense for this reason? So not going to really help you much. You're pretty much stuck with what you've got.
I think, Greg, that's a great question. You talk about the increase in the predictor base and with the 300,000 animals more or less last year, and then, you look at SNP markers going on to 143,000. So I can see the same thing. Why wouldn't we gain that just a little bit quicker than that reliability, just a little bit quicker? So, it comes with restrictions, but certainly that it does drive that.
And I obviously think it's worth working on.
Yes.
Thank you, George, for your enthusiasm and your presentation. Your signature is in your DNA. I just want to take Greg's question and flip it upside down. For some of these harder to measure traits, what's the threshold of reliability that AGIL thinks perhaps we should look at to offer it to the public to give us some early access to some of these
these areas that we want to explore further.
Yeah, so is there a threshold that it's not worth offering it because it doesn't add very much? And I guess we certainly have been willing to offer traits that have fairly low gains, and particularly for other breeds. So long as we don't think we're giving you misinformation, I'm inclined to add information. In some sense, any program that we have gets better with time as we work out the data quality issues initially, and certainly with new traits, sort of fine-tuning that so we know what the appropriate edits are and what the issues are makes sense. I guess that's a long way of saying I don't know, as we've really looked at what would be the necessary threshold. I think once you spend all the time on developing a trait, you'd hope that you could make it worth reporting. But you know, again, one thing I didn't mention is that with the rise of the Council on Dairy Cattle Breeding, we are focusing more on the research. So while we would certainly advise on what we think is appropriate, ultimately the industry has a mechanism for deciding what things they want included. There's a research advisory group that helps set research priorities, and then the council board meets to decide what changes to implement in the system. So I'm going to duck that one.
Don?
As a young genomic bull or young genomic female starts having genomic results on their progeny prior to any of them calving, do those genomic results have any effect on the sire or the dam genomic numbers?
Now that's a good question, because you would think that they should, but they don't. And the reason that they don't is that an important sort of mind thought to get clear is that with traditional evaluations, the evaluation is largely the animal's own information, both the observations on it and the information on its parents. So you take the animal, its sire, and its dam, you've pretty much described all the sources of information that are going to generate that evaluation. In the SNP situation, we have the, right now we're using about 61,000 SNPs. We have a process, so for Holstein for milk yield, say, we estimate how much difference does it make in milk yield to go from the A allele to the B allele, let's say. So we have 61,000 estimates, pluses and minuses. So for a particular animal, we say which alleles did it have, we add them all up, and that's the result for the animal. So you can see this is based on what are those SNP effect estimates, which are really a summary of all the animals in the predictor population. So the animals that just have, that don't have, that aren't in the predictor population have no influence on those SNP effect estimates. But I mean, it, you know, even for ourselves, it's, oh yes, you know, that's, it works that way instead of that way. It's counter-intuitive.
Thanks, George. One of the slides that were very interesting, and certainly I'm sure you've been asked this before, is, you know, when you show that, you know, genetic gain and in net merit over time, and how much genetic progress you make every year, and how much you've made over the past several years, you still look at, you know, your rollback at every 4.5, I'm going to call it 4.5 to 5 years. Is there any discussion on or why not you can change that frequency of rollback when you see that much genetic gain over that period of time?
Yeah, that's actually one of the take-home messages of my attending this conference. I was president at the laboratory when we settled on the 5-year intervals for changing the base. Before that, we hadn't changed it for a long time, and there was the argument that people should always pick the highest animals, and it shouldn't matter what you set to zero. But then the argument was, well, they're going to get astronomic values. That won't really mean anything. You do a base change, it's time for people to reevaluate their programs. Every 5 years, we can probably put up with the disruption of doing it every 5 years. Now, after attending this meeting and thinking about the fact, well, if we're doubling the rate of genetic trend, then the amount of difference that occurs in a 5-year period would be at least twice as much. Maybe that's a bigger disruption than, so maybe there's an argument for changing it more often. As those who actually have to do the work and make sure the programs all work and all, it's if I go home to my colleagues and say, oh, they want to change the base every year, they'll send me back, I'm fair. But But I think that, you know, again, this is, from a scientific point of view, we'd like to do whatever we can to maximize rate of genetic gain, because, you know, the whole food efficiency, food production, all that. So if it would cause people to do a better job of their bull selection by making a change in policy, that would make sense. But probably we would defer that discussion to the council. And in a sense, that's it makes sense that the council, as the representative of the industry, needs to consider how do they transfer information to the industries to facilitate good decision making, and how do they present the results to make them most useful. So I think it's a valid issue to raise.
Thanks, George. Certainly, I can tell from your answer it's not the first time you've been asked that question, and certainly it gets passed around, you know, particularly after the last genomic or the last genetic proof run as well. So, any further questions from the floor? Randy?
Just one follow-up on the 80% reliability. After seeing a presentation from Illumina, it seems like with sequencing coming down as low as $1,000 a run now, and new machines coming out, new chips coming out, and I know, you know, you don't want to guess, but it would seem logical that in the next 5 years, that with new technology, new chip, more information, that we would go to a certain point towards 100%. What do you think theoretically is possible based on what you've seen in, you know, your work?
Right, well, and at one level, we've been a little bit disappointed that when we added more SNPs, we didn't get a very big increase. So that's why I'm a little gun-shy about saying, oh, I'm busy working on this project, it's gonna have this huge benefit. The project I'm working on, given somewhat disappointing results earlier, this last going to 85,000 was at least better than the previous results, but it doesn't jump us from 80 to 90. As I pointed out, I think the way we have the assumptions that we're making now, that there's only 90% that can be associated with the SNPs, that right now that would be the limit. Now, as we are more successful in identifying the causative variants, that could increase, because right now the SNPs, of course, aren't perfectly correlated with the variants, so there's always there necessarily be a little slippage. I guess ultimately you're saying that by looking at the DNA, can we get the same level of accuracy that we get when we have $10,000? And, you know, I guess to do that, it would be, maybe you'd have to take into account more aspects of the genome. But when we have the sequence data, ultimately we have what drives if it's inheritable, it has to be in that DNA someplace. So if with long enough planning horizon, I guess I'd say that we should be able to explain the variation. Maybe Tom will have a chance to give his two cents on that thought.
Thank you. Great, thank you, Randy. Thanks, George. Brian?
I just want to add to the discussion about increase in gains of accuracy and the potential. And George, clarify if I'm in misinterpreting or misunderstanding. But in actual fact, we have two forces going on simultaneously. And one is the increase of our methodologies and the number of SNPs and the kinds of SNPs that we're using. So yes, we expect a gain going on there. But simultaneously, we're decreasing generation interval. And so the animals of primary interest of selection are getting further away from your prediction population and reference population. So the easy way to interpret that from an industry side is that when we first were starting with genomics, we were buying young bulls that were sons of proven sires. So they're just one generation away from your prediction population. Now we're looking at young bulls that are at least two generations, maybe even three generations with IVF, away from your predictor population. I know in Canada, our accuracy of prediction of sons that are proven sires is 5% higher in reliability than the sons of genomic young sires, where they're grandsons of proven sires. So we're slipping by 5% by going younger and younger. So we have to be careful in terms of saying where are we going and how fast can we get there, because the younger you get and the further away you get from the reference population, you're going to be slipping in that accuracy compared to the other way around. So your comments, please, George.
You'd think linkage decay would be an important part of that, though, right? Linkage decay would be, and you know, with the when they talk about the sequence data, the implication is that we're getting a substantial number of causative variants. So, I mean, when pressed to say what's the ultimate future, that's why. But I certainly subscribe to Brian's point that as we get further away from the data, and that's actually one of the critical issues on developing the council structure in the first place, was to ensure that there'd be continued incentive to provide data, because with genomics, you don't have to have any production information, as we're just saying, to get a reasonably accurate evaluation. But if you go on too long, the whole thing can kind of fall apart. So while the current fee structure doesn't put a big incentive, it does put some incentive, and it generates resources that can be used to help ensure the flow of data.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? I think at this time we're pretty much on schedule, and George, I think in summary, you know, with the change that's been developed and how it's brought that certainly strong, as much as we've made a rate of gain on the genetic side, you can certainly see that the rate of gain on collecting data has been pretty advanced on your side as well. So we see the challenges, and we certainly see the accuracy and the intervals and the questions that get brought forward. So with that, I'd ask you to please give George a great appreciation for the information that he's brought forward. Thanks, George. And George will be around for the next little while as well to answer some more questions.